This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 123 was recorded on June 21st, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. I've often joked that perhaps the OPEC ministers are listening to Macro Voices when we see policy actions in line with what we've predicted on this program. So it was a real honor for me to learn from Joe McMonagle's tweet today that at least one OPEC minister at the Grand Gala dinner in Vienna ahead of the OPEC meeting was overheard discussing the crude oil special that we ran last week on Macro Voices with another OPEC minister. So I'm honored to welcome our esteemed new listeners within the OPEC ranks, and I hope that our coverage of crude oil markets will continue to interest them. Gentlemen, the work that you do has profound and very important impact on the entire planet, and so it's my honor personally to know that this podcast has captured the interest of such esteemed policymakers as yourselves. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Luke is well known for his secular dollar bearish outlook, which is based on the view that the dollar is losing its hegemony over the global financial system. But despite these longer-term views, even Luke Grohman has turned tactically bullish on the U.S. dollar. We'll cover the dollar and much more in this week's interview. Luke will also be a speaker at our Macro Voices live event in Toronto on August 10th, so I'll ask him to share with us what he plans to present in Toronto as well. And speaking of that event in Toronto, the tickets are selling like hotcakes. So if you can join us in Toronto, be sure to buy your tickets before they sell out. You can find the registration link in your Research Roundup email or on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview for our post-game segment when Patrick will present a chart book examining how the 2017 synchronized global growth narrative has broken down, with emerging market equities, bonds, and currencies now all signaling trouble ahead.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 continues to consolidate on the downside. I have a chart I want to share in the post game. What's your thinking here on the S&P 500 right now?
You know, it looked real ugly at the start of the week. We saw a bounce, which looked to me like a short squeeze, but that bounce did not really get past the recent highs. Now we're headed back down as we're speaking Thursday afternoon, 2573. We're not quite back down to the lows that we had 2 days ago, earlier this week, which were down around 2735. But, you know, we're getting there. And it feels to me, Patrick, I've also heard a number of technicians talking about DeMarc indicators lining up bearishly on several different time frames. Now, I have to admit, I'm not a DeMarc indicator expert myself, but I know it's an indicator that a lot of technicians put a lot of faith in. It feels to me like maybe some kind of short-term top is in. Now, I'm not saying that the summer rally is over, but I think maybe there's some more downside before we see another wave higher, if we see a wave higher. You know, it's really hard to say. As we've talked about in previous shows, this rally that we're seeing is really not that impressive, and I'm not sure how much more upside it has left. Maybe we're done. Who knows?
All right. Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because for 3 days in a row, we've seen the U.S. dollar index prairie dog above the 95 level and immediately throw back as we consolidate here just below the 95 handle as we're recording. What's your thinking here on the dollar? Is this breakout going to stick, or are we just forming an overhead resistance here?
You know, I think there's probably still more upside here. There is a counter argument, though. If you look at the chart, we broke through 95. And of course, the June futures contract is expiring. That's a quarterly contract. So the next one is September. The numbers are a little bit different. But looking at the September contract, you know, we broke 95. We retreated down to a mid 94 handle. You could make the argument that it was a false breakout, maybe, or the beginnings of a false breakout above 95, and it's going to retreat from here. Frankly, I think that's wishful thinking for the bears, and the bears have made a lot of top calls as this rally has progressed, and so far they've all been wrong. Of course, anything could change, but I think that the more likely scenario is that there's more upside here. And if nothing else, Luke Groman, of all people, I mean, Luke is one of the most dollar bearish people on earth in the long-term big picture. Even Luke is going to tell us in this interview that he's bullish on the dollar, at least in the short term. So I think this rally still has some legs to it. How far it goes, I'm not sure. Long-term, I do see, as Luke does, the bearish argument for the dollar, but for the immediate time horizon, it looks to me like the direction is up.
Now let's move on to crude oil. Before we get to the inventory numbers, what's your latest thinking on the OPEC meetings Friday and Saturday?
Well, first, let's describe those two meetings. The official OPEC meeting is Friday, and that's all the OPEC ministers. Then on Saturday, there's a meeting between Russia and other non-OPEC producers in addition to OPEC. Some people call that group OPEC Plus or NOPEC. Call it what you will. Those are the two meetings that are lined up. Now, there's a lot of moving parts here. There's insiders know what's going on, and I don't, so can't tell you for certain what's going to happen, but I'll tell you what my take is. Russia and Saudi Arabia were super clear more than a week ago, saying an increase in production is inevitable. I think that they chose that word inevitable carefully, and I think they meant it. And what I interpret that to mean is that the deal is already done between Russia and Saudi Arabia that there will be some kind of an increase in production. Now, it may not be called an increase in production. I'll come back to that in just a minute, but I think there's going to be one. The question is whether they can get OPEC to support it so that the cartel appears to act in solidarity, or if Russia and Saudi Arabia will have to act on their own, independent of the OPEC decision. Iran has been making very loud noises, trying to do everything that they can to insist on no increase in production at the OPEC meeting. Now, in theory, Patrick, OPEC rules require a unanimous vote. So even just one country like Iran could block an actual decision that, on behalf of the entire OPEC organization, decides to increase production. And some people are speculating that that's exactly what's going to happen. That may be the case. I'm sure that Russia and Saudi Arabia are probably lobbying the Iranian oil minister pretty hard, saying, hey, look, we're going to do this with or without you. It's just a question of whether we act with the appearance of solidarity of OPEC or if you force us to go do it on our own. Play ball with us. I think that that is a negotiation that's really hard to know exactly where it's going to fall, but it potentially sets up a kind of whipsaw situation in the market, which I'll describe momentarily. In any case, I think that Russia and Saudi Arabia have probably kind of work together to set expectations intentionally. I'm guessing that what they've long since agreed to, long before this meeting, is some number, I'm going to guess off the top of my head, 500,000 barrels per day of increased production between Russia and Saudi Arabia. That is something that they're going to do no matter what. Now, my guess is the reason that Russia has been very vocal, throwing around numbers like 1.5 to 1.8 million barrels of additional production, is they want to condition the market. They want to get the market ready for that possibility of 1.5 to 1.8, so that when they actually announce their 500,000 barrel increase, the market is conditioned and you don't get a big downside because it's a breath of relief and everybody says, okay, it's not as big as we thought it was going to be. So I'm guessing that they've already picked their number and that they are strategically delivering messaging which conditions the market so that there won't be too much downside reaction in price to the announcement of an increase of production. The other thing I think that they're very likely to do is they will change the words to make it sound like there is no increase in production. If they said it's a continuation of the cut that has been in place for however long it's been in place, it's not going to change. It's going to continue. Okay, that's a message that sounds like things are staying the same. But oh, by the way, we're going to increase 500,000 barrels of production in order to make up for the overcompliance which has occurred as a result of Iranian sanctions and the political situation in Venezuela. So it's still an increase, but they say it's not an increase. It's just a continuation of the cut. But because of the overcompliance that existed, they're going to bring that overcompliance down by shifting which countries are allowed to produce how much. Those are guesses on my part. It's very clear here to me that Russia and Saudi Arabia have a plan. They're working closely together. They know what they want to accomplish. What that is, we'll find out in the next few days. Now, if Iran prevails, it is possible that we could get to a no-change event at the Friday meeting. That's the official OPEC meeting, because Iran could block any kind of change that they might want to announce if Iran wants to kind of play that veto card. If that happens, you have a potential for a lot of upside on price in Friday in reaction to no increase of production announced at the meeting. And then I think it's a setup for the Saturday meeting to be where Russia and Saudi Arabia announce that they're going to move forward with a production increase anyway, whether Iran likes it or not. And now you've got the potential of a really big whipsaw down in price on the Sunday futures open, because the market was pricing Friday's news, and it changes over the course of Saturday's meeting. Certainly, Saudi Arabia and Russia don't want to see that whipsaw happen. They are very committed to doing everything that they can in order to provide stability to this market. So if that were to start to play out, I would expect Saudi Arabia and Russia to be very vocal after the OPEC meeting, saying, hey, wait, there's another meeting tomorrow. This doesn't mean it's over. You know, keep the expectations set where they've been set. I think that would be their plan B. Their plan A is they'd probably prefer to influence Iran to just have solidarity and do it all in the Friday meeting. We'll see what happens. In any case, markets are going crazy on Thursday. We saw some bizarre action in time spreads on Thursday morning, with near dated, particularly August to September and September, October time spreads just exploded through the roof. Now, that would indicate that somebody thinks there's going to be a problem with supply coming into Cushing, Oklahoma. Is the OPEC meeting really the explanation of this blowout in time spreads that seems to be more focused in the WTI strip than in the Brent strip? It's hard to imagine that. So is something else going on? It remains to be seen. But there is very, very bizarre action happening in time spreads, particularly near the front of the WTI curve. And I don't know whether it's OPEC expectation related or not.
All right, well, let's move on to the inventory numbers, because the crude oil is trading just above $65 and doesn't seem to be making any big moves. Obviously, I think the OPEC meeting itself is pinning it here. But what's your thinking here on inventory numbers?
Well, Patrick, we saw a 5.9 million barrel drawdown on inventory this week, and that was after 4.1 million barrels last week. Super big crude oil inventory drawdowns last week and this week. On the other hand, it is summer driving season starting, so seasonally it's not totally unexpected. Cushing, Oklahoma also drawing down 1.3 million barrels this week, and that's starting to get to be kind of a concerning trend. For a while, we saw Cushing building inventory, even when national numbers were being drawn down. Now we've seen a couple of weeks in a row of significant Cushing drawdowns. That brings Cushing down to about 41% of capacity. It's kind of a low number to be going into the beginning of summer driving season. Well, these drawdowns all sound massively bullish. Why didn't the price spike up dramatically? The other side is finished products. Massive, massive builds. 3.3 million barrels on gasoline, 2.7 million barrels on distillates. That completely erases the 2.1 million barrel drawdown on distillates last week. And, you know, there's another 500,000 barrels of surplus on the net basis beyond that. So we've got big builds in products, big drawdowns in crude. That kind of sent the market up, then down, then up again, then down again, and so forth. Production was unchanged on the week at 10.9 million barrels. Remember, though, we had 100,000 barrel per day increase last week, which was just massive. That annualizes to 5 million barrels per day on an annualized basis if it were sustained. So, you know, if you average together last week and this week, it's still 50,000 a week. We'll see what happens next week. But so far, I don't think this one print is reason to think that that trend of production growth is ending. I think it's very likely to continue. Massive, massive exports. And again, the Brent WTI spread is what's driving a lot of this. 2.4 million barrels per day works out to about 16.6 million barrels exported this week from the United States. And finally, the weather this week, particularly the Houston Ship Channel has been closed as a result of heavy weather at sea outside of the Ship Channel. That is going to bias next week's numbers considerably because the rules for who's allowed to come in certain weather conditions with imports and who's allowed to go out in certain weather conditions with exports are different. There may be cases where exports are allowed and imports are not allowed because of the weather, and those ships are just waiting to get in, so it's an anomaly in the data, but it could really throw things through a loop next week. So I would say fade the importance of next week's inventory just because it will be skewed as a result of weather. Bottom line, though, it's all about OPEC, NOPEC right now. What's going to happen by the time the Saturday meeting is over? That's the real question. And will we have potentially a no-action Friday that results in a price up before a price down on Sunday? I have to believe Russia and Saudi Arabia will be very vocal in setting expectations to avoid that scenario, but it may start to play out anyway. In any case, Patrick, please remember both of our guests agreed last week that the downside here from a production increase is mostly market reaction stuff. They don't think that there's reason to be bearish longer term. They think that this is probably a buy the dip opportunity, might go lower on the announcement, depending on how big it is, of an increase in production, but that's probably a buy-the-dip opportunity, according to both Anas Alhaji and Joe McMonagle in last week's crude oil special.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold, because we've been talking about that tight range that gold has been trading in for almost a month. And finally, with that U.S. dollar breakout last week on Mario Draghi's comments, the gold market finally broke, and we had that rapid drop down toward 1280, and now we've traded down to even just below 1270 as we're recording here. What's your thinking here on bullion?
Well, very clearly, the trend is down, and I think that's mostly about the dollar up. And even Loke Groman, who is a big dollar bear in the long term, is got a view that the dollar could continue. He's going to have quite a bit more to say about that in the feature interview. What I would say, though, here is, if anything, I think the resiliency of gold in the face of this dollar action is a real testament. A lot of people said 1305 to 1307 was the key support level. Baby, if we break that, we're going straight to 1200 is going to be the next stop. Well, we didn't. We got down pretty quickly to 1280, and now we're back down to just a hair under 1270. And yeah, the trend has been down, but I don't see the bottom falling out the way a lot of people predicted would happen if the dollar rallied. So as long as the dollar is rallying, I think it definitely presents a headwind for gold. But gold is going to have its day. I think that the next really big move for gold is definitely going to be to the upside. The question is just how long can it go to the downside before that dollar strength runs out and we see the beginning of a really big uptrend. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got more downside, but I think the resilience that we're seeing is pretty impressive. I know you've got more to say, so let's come back to this subject of gold in the postgame segment after the feature interview with Loke Groman.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, which is hovering around this 2.9% level. Clearly, we're off the 3.10 level on the upside, and yields continue to consolidate. We kind of had that discussion last week about some traders positioning themselves for yields to even potentially head down towards 2.60 into the summer. I have no idea whether that's going to come to fruition or not, but it certainly feels like yields have taken a break here. What's your thinking on the 10-year Treasury yield?
Well, Patrick, as you say, they've definitely taken a break. And as I struggle to explain this, and I admit that it's a struggle, the best that I can come up with is, okay, a lot of people had the story in their head that if we broke 305, that was going to be that watershed moment where everything was going to fall apart. Sure enough, we broke 305. We got all the way to 310, 311, I think, on an intraday basis. And a lot of people piled in and ended up getting stopped out of their trades and getting frustrated. So I think the market's regrouping here to figure out, you know, was it just not time yet, or is the move actually in the other direction? And it's the usual tug of war. The bulls and the bears are struggling to see who's in charge. I was surprised. I thought that there was room for a really significant short squeeze if we didn't see the move continue past 305 or stay above 305. And, you know, if that was a short squeeze, it was a fairly short-lived short squeeze, and it took us, what, 275 or so was the low print that we've seen since the breakout beyond 305. I would have expected to go farther than that on a vicious short squeeze, which is what I thought was possible based on how lopsided the positioning was in the Treasury market. And what we see in the commitment of traders is there's still plenty of short positioning. Not everybody is abandoning this trade. So I don't really have a solid explanation or view as to what comes next. Luke Grohman's going to have plenty to say, though, so let's save the rest for the feature interview.
This week's featured interview guest is Luke Grohman, founder of Forest for the Trees, and also one of our featured speakers at Macro Voices Live Conference in Toronto on August 10th. Be sure to get your tickets if you can attend. There's a registration link in the Research Roundup email, as well a banner on our macrovoices.com website. Meanwhile, Eric's interview with Luke Grohman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is this week's feature interview guest is Luke Grohman, founder of Forest for the Trees. Luke prepared a fantastic deck of 35 charts and graphs for us, so be sure to download those. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com and click the red button that says Looking for the Download. Luke, it's great to have you back on the program. Now, you have been one of our most outspoken long-term secular dollar bears. You've articulated a very coherent argument, which basically says it's inevitable that the U.S. dollar will lose its hegemony in the long term over the world financial system, and not having that artificial demand for dollars is going to weaken the dollar in the long term. But I believe that you've actually turned short-term dollar bullish. So please fill us in. What has changed your thinking? Is it a change, or is this just a tactical view that you have? And what do you see, both short, medium, and long-term, for the U.S. dollar?
Absolutely. Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me back on, and it's certainly great to be here. Yeah, we really had a tactical shift a little over 3 months ago, really, and it was based on effectively what we were seeing in markets. And so as we stand on the dollar versus where we came into the year, we think that the second half of the year is going to be really what we call on slide two, a tale of $2 trades. And so there's dollar trade number one, which is, you know, near term, a U.S. dollar short squeeze is Fed hawkishness, you know, despite softening emerging market currencies, we think is likely to continue. And we've talked about this in our research over the last 3 months as the Fed potentially shooting the hostage, or in more draconian terms, burning down the world. And that is sort of the near-term tactical shift you're referring to. The second trade of the $2 trades is still this structural dollar trade that, to us, makes the long dollar look like perhaps, you know, on a structural basis, you know, the biggest picking up nickels in front of a steamroller trade since AIG was minting money selling subprime mortgage insurance in the 2000s. And so when you go to slide three in our slide deck, you know, you should be familiar with, and your listeners will be familiar with from having us on before, 3Q14 to us was a huge moment. You had global FX reserve balances fall for the first time in 70 years. Nobody alive trading has ever been trading during a period of time when U.S. deficits began to matter again, yet they did. And it's interesting, as you go to slide four, what that prior slide showed is that deficits had effectively been funded by foreign central banks in big part for 70 years, but since the third quarter of 14, it's had to been funded by the global private sector, and in particular, the U.S. domestic private sector. And we thought it was really interesting, you can see here on slide four, is this recognition that suddenly U.S. deficits are being more financed by the U.S. private sector rather than global central banks is beginning to go a bit more mainstream. This is a chart that was available in the public realm from Deutsche Bank, a Deutsche Bank slide deck. And course, we've highlighted on your program and elsewhere in the past that some of this domestic purchases of U.S. treasuries by the domestic private sector has been, quote unquote, encouraged by bank HQLA reforms, money market fund reforms, and most recently, tax reform here in the United States. And all of this worked to help encourage the funding of U.S. deficits by the U.S. private sector. And then you get to slide five, and everything was going well until, for the first time since 2009, you saw the U.S. federal deficit begin to increase as a percent of GDP. And as we've highlighted before on your program, so I'll move through it quickly, but this to us was a real watershed moment. As you look back, you'd only seen the deficit widen as a percent of GDP seven times in history. Six of those prior widenings were followed by a U.S. recession within 12 to 14 months. The one time it did not was in the mid-80s when the dollar was significantly devalued at the Plaza Accord. And so, you know, this time last year and really in 4Q16 when we saw this, a lot of people were looking for a stronger dollar. Our case was, you know, based on heavily on this chart that, you know, unless the dollar was significantly devalued, the U.S. economy would likely weaken pretty notably, and that would have some pretty negative implications for the system in general. And what this prior chart on slide five showed means that, you know, the slide you see on slide six, this vicious cycle chart, is now engaged where, you know, you start at the top of the chart, deficits rise, it drives an increase in federal borrowing. You move to number two, which is foreign central banks aren't lending to the U.S. government on net anymore. So the U.S. has to borrow from the private sector because federal government is borrowing so much. It crowds out the global private sector, and that drives LIBOR up and drives treasury yields up, which on LIBOR in particular, we've seen rise since 3Q14 when we saw global FX reserve balances peak. And then you get to slide four as federal borrowing crowds out the private sector, rates rise, and that slows the U.S. economy. You sort of wash, rinse, repeat. And this is what began last year in 4Q16 once you saw deficits begin widening as a percent of GDP again. This is a subject we've been touching on really since late February in our research, which is that if deficits matter again, as you can see here on slide seven, if deficits matter again, the U.S. becomes subject to its own impossible trilemma, which is a little different than sort of the classic emerging market trilemma in FX markets. And the U.S.'s trilemma is that the Fed can only have two of the following three things. Number one, rising Fed funds rate. Number two, a stable or rising dollar. Or number three, rising stock prices. And so as we came into 2018, we thought we were going to see more of what we saw in 2017, you know, what we just described in terms of the widening deficit. In 2017, the U.S. saw a falling dollar, rising stock prices, rising short-term rates. And as we came into 2018, we thought this combination of the U.S. impossible trilemma would continue. That was until the long end of the Treasury curve sold off in February's equity market sell-off. And we think that was an event that really spooked the Fed. It caught our attention. And that was really when we started to shift our view near-term tactically on the dollar. And so if you go to slide eight, there's three charts here from the Fed FRED database. All three are periods of time when the U.S., when the S&P 500 sold off 10% in a relatively short period of time. And what you can see, you know, the S&P in each chart's in blue, 10-year treasury yields in each chart are red. And, in 2010, stocks down, 10-year yields down. 2015, stocks down 10%, 10-year yields down big. 2018, you can see a very different pattern, which was that stocks fell 10%, one of the fastest 10% sell-offs in history, and yet 10-year yields were up. That long bond sold off on a very sharp U.S. equity sell-off. And so for us, that was a big moment. You saw, I know at least one equity strategist at Bank of America noted that treasuries were trading like a risky asset in the first part of 2018. We think the reason that was, as you go to slide nine, is for the first time in 70 years, U.S. federal deficit was widening as a percent of GDP during a peacetime economic expansion, which all else equal should be a negative for the dollar. You can see this chart here on slide nine. It's budget balance against the U.S. unemployment rate. And you can see that little gap back during the Vietnam War directly contributed to the dollar's weakness in the 1970s. And so it does beg the question structurally, you know, what's going to happen with this gap? And so, as we said, post-February, our shift outlook on the dollar near-term and tactically began to shift where, as we're looking at it from this trilemma framework, you know, we thought you'd see dollar down, stocks up again in 2018. We thought you'd start to get, and the Fed quickly supported with their language, get more hawkish to support the dollar, to support the long end of the Treasury curve. because we think they really got spooked by that treasury sell-off in the market sell-off. And that's what we've termed shooting the hostage, so to speak. As you can see here on slide 10, what we mean by that is this is the first time that you have seen the Fed raising rates while the deficit is increasing as a percent of GDP since 1974 and 1978. And in both of those instances, the Fed was effectively defending the dollar, trying to stamp out inflation when they were doing that. So the key question for us at this point in terms of the dollar trade number one, us being more tactically bullish on the dollar, has been how far will the Fed take shooting the hostage? And if you go to slide 11, the question is, will they take it as far as Paul Volcker did back in the late 70s? You can see here, this chart is the 10-year spread. And you can see, even allowing for the fact that rates were higher on an absolute basis back then than they were certainly now, rates were wildly negative. And interestingly, it was after Volcker was told by EU creditors in October 1979 at an IMF meeting to, quote, take stern action to stem severe dollar weakness. And so nobody thinks it's possible, as far as we can tell, that the Fed would be willing to do this. But, you know, given the degree of de-dollarization of global commodity markets, which we've been talking about for a while, we'll touch on a little bit later in the slide deck, we think it might be necessary. And so when you go to slide 12, you can see here, this was the headline from a report March 1st, 2018. You know, we shifted our near-term view on the dollar based on what we were seeing in markets and also on risk markets. A big near-term shift in our thinking. We thought the Fed's trying to stabilize the dollar. And so, you know, we thought that that would be ultimately probably negative for the economy, but also probably positive for continued volatility on rates and equities. And when you take a step back and say, all right, why are we focused on this trilemma for the United States if deficits don't matter anymore? You have to go to slide 13. I think it's a very important and very underappreciated set of charts, which is the U.S. impossible trilemma is really a function of U.S. policymakers establishing a system over the past 25 years that has heavily tied U.S. tax receipts and also U.S. consumption, U.S. tax receipts to rising equity prices through consumer spending via options, restricted stock, IRAs, et cetera. And so these charts are really interesting. Again, it's Fed data. If you take a look at the year-over-year change in U.S. federal tax receipts, which are the blue line in both charts, against year-over-year change in total U.S. equity market cap, which is the red line in both charts, you can see from, call it, 1974 through about 1998, there's very little to no to almost, slightly negative correlation. And then post 96, 97, 98 timeframe, they're not only are they very closely correlated, but equities lead tax receipts. And it's underappreciated on the street how this relationship, number one. Number two, it's also not well understood why. And the key was that back in, I believe it was either 1994 or 1995, President Clinton signed legislation that eliminated the deductibility of executive cash compensation over $1 million a year to the corporation. But he exempted incentive comp of any kind. And so, of course, what we've seen since is incentive comp has gone crazy. Cash comp has not. And so what you've ended up having is, that was a big driver to the growing wealth discrepancy in this country. And that's why you ended up with this situation where equity markets now lead tax receipts.
Let me interrupt for a minute there. I know you're on a roll here, Luke, but I've got a few questions going back to slide 9, actually, before we get further into the trilemma. It's a question that I think is so important, and everybody's got a different view on it. When we talk about what happened with this breakdown of correlations between equity and bond yields, first half of the question is this the tail wagging the dog? Was it the bond yields that crashed the equity market, or was it the sell-off in equities that resulted in the move up in treasury yields, the down in treasury prices? And the related question, part two, is this is potentially a very threatening correlation change because so many people in this risk parity trade have assumed that stocks and bonds are inversely correlated. If they start moving in the same direction in terms of price, suddenly a whole lot of risk models break down. So is this a change which is going to persist for a while, or was it an anomaly? And if so, why did it happen?
Great set of questions. Yes, I think it is going to persist as long as global central banks do not sterilize U.S. deficits. In other words, as long as that first chart does not grow nearly as fast or as fast or faster than U.S. deficits grow on an absolute basis in terms of dollars, then the correlation between equities, you know, this risk parity trade will likely continue to break down. This is really the crux of the trilemma, which is that if deficits are going to grow and the U.S. private sector has to pay for its own stuff, these deficits are growing a huge percentage of discretionary income. You basically get into a question of you need the equity market to try to fund the treasury market is what you really end up with. And that's a bit of a size mismatch. And so that's why we get into this impossible trilemma framework. In terms of your question of which one was it? Was a tail wagging the dog or vice versa? I'm trying to remember back to while I was watching that. But, I think it came back to the dollar vis-a-vis the treasury market. In other words, if we are now in an environment where global central banks are not going to fund U.S. deficits, and they have not done so on net in 4 years, we need someone private to buy it. And, you know, we've talked about how you had banks were effectively forced to do so, and then you had money market funds effectively forced to do so. 2017, look, we tricked people, right? Hey, buy a 10-year treasury, clip a 2.6% coupon, it's risk-free, which sounds great until you lose 12% on the currency. And so I think as you came into this year, as the dollar continued to weaken, I think as the Trump administration showed up in Switzerland, you know, in the third or fourth week of January and said, hey, we're going to wail on the dollar some more this year. To me, I think that was really the global private sector saying, wait a second, you think we're going to sit here and lose 1% a month on the currency again and clip a 2.6% coupon? When you walk through it that way, I think it was the bond market. People say, where were the bond market vigilantes? I think that was a little mini bond market vigilante move where the global private sector just said, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. We're not going to take these kind of losses in our dollar holdings again. You better do something. So I think that was really the message conveyed to the Fed, either by the markets or by someone directly.
Moving on to slide 11, anytime anybody talks about what Volcker did, I just have to bring up, Paul Volcker himself has in a very outspoken way said that it would be categorically impossible today to do what he did back in 79-80, because at the time, the U.S. Federal debt was just not that big of a deal. Of course, I mean, it was big, but it wasn't anything close to what it is today. And Volcker has been outspoken in saying it's completely, totally impossible to take the approach that he took of radical increases of short-term rates, because there is no way to possibly service the U.S. debt. So those kinds of policy options, in Volcker's own words, are no longer possible. Now, that may not be exactly what we're talking about here. So please clarify exactly what you mean by Volcker shoots the hostage. What kind of policy move are we talking about? And is it something that is still plausible to do today?
Volcker's right. It's not plausible. You know, and in the report that we highlighted this and in others since, we've said it's not possible. It's not going to work. But that doesn't mean the U.S. can't try. You know, what we equated it to in one report is, you know, if you've ever seen the scene at the end of the Oliver Stone's movie Platoon, you know, the great movie, very moving movie, they're getting overrun. And so they call in an airstrike inside the wire, so to speak. Basically, like, you know, to them, the guy calling it in, the risk of collateral damage to his own, you know, in this case, quote unquote, soldiers is worth the cost in their judgment of being completely overrun and losing everybody. And that is the metaphor we've used, where Volcker's right. They can't do it. The financialization of the U.S. economy is much greater. The demographics are much different. The debt levels are much different. It's just different every single way. But that doesn't mean they can't try. And pronouncements from the Fed, even up to last week or 2 weeks ago, when Powell effectively said, we don't really care what's happening to emerging market currencies. To me, this is something, you know, one of these sort of big picture views that much of the street is missing is, you know, somebody asked us recently, you know, Luke, if you could have one piece of information right now for the back half of the year, what would it be? And I said, oh, that's easy. I said, I would love to have ahead of time the degree to which this Fed tightening is either just a standard rate hiking cycle versus how much is a case that the Fed is either weaponizing the dollar or being weaponized by the U.S. government to defend increasing de-dollarization of global commodity markets. Because look, if this is just a standard rate hiking cycle, they're not going to shoot the hostage or you know, burn down the world or call in an airstrike inside the wire. What's going to happen is probably by late third quarter of this year, early fourth quarter, the economy is going to start to soften and they're going to back off the number of rate hikes and the dollar is going to weaken and emerging markets are going to run and the equity markets are going to reaccelerate. And away we go, sort of standard cycle. You know, curve will re-steepen. There's a whole bunch of trades there that you can really put on across your book regardless of what you're trading. The flip side of that is if this is them attempting to run the Volcker playbook, nobody's positioned for that. And you're going to want to be in dollars and in 30-day T-bills and maybe gold. Maybe. And everything else, I think, will just get absolutely whaled on. That person was basically asking that same question. Can they run the Volcker again? No, they can't. But if they're willing to, you know, sort of quote unquote, kill some of their own soldiers. And what I mean by that is, you know, U.S. shale, U.S. industrials, we'll take the ISM below 50 again. You're going to blow up high yield markets with the hope that China and some of these other EMs blow up fast and worst. Is that possible? It's not my base case, but I think the odds of that happening, I think the street thinks that's a 0% chance of that happening. And I think the numbers, while still a tail risk, I think are above zero.
Okay, I want to come back, though, to what the policy objective is, because a lot of people, you know, if you think about what Volcker is known for, the fight that was going on at the time is they're fighting double-digit inflation, and the big rise up to whatever it was, 21% short-term interest rates, was necessitated by fighting more than 10 to 12% of annual consumer price inflation. Now, in this environment, you know, the Fed is struggling to try to create 2% price inflation. So where does the Volcker playbook analogy come into play? Why is this the Volcker situation in terms of what you see the motives being for this rate hiking cycle?
To me, the increased hawkishness in the February meeting minutes, I think it was either the 20th or 21st of February, there was a really interesting passage that caught my attention in light of this trilemma framework, which was the Fed flat out said, last year, U.S. rate hikes did not tighten liquidity because of the weaker dollar and the rise in asset prices. And there it was, rates up, dollar down, you know, asset prices up. To me, the catalyst is the treasury market. They cannot lose the long end of the treasury market. And so while they're not fighting inflation in terms of what we were talking about in the 1970s, again, taking the step back, the issue then was they were defending the dollar. The reason inflation was running the way it was because 8 years earlier, Nixon had just sort of unilaterally said, you know, see ya to the global currency system. And, you know, you sort of had 8 chaotic years of, you know, setting up the petrodollar and a variety of other things happening, you know, that culminated, you know, there's this great Fed archive paper that they put out in 2005 called The Reform of October 1979. Volcker flew to Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and he met with a couple different creditors, and they basically flat out said, you've got to fix the dollar. And he was there for less than 24 hours, flew all the way back to Washington, which, you know, I know flying to London is hard on me at my age. Volcker was older then, like flying 8 hours there and back. Couldn't have been fun. And he immediately came back and started tightening rates. And so I think when you say we're not fighting those types of inflation numbers, I think that's exactly right. But what I think why there's a similarity here, why I think it's the right analog is, you know, back then it was flat out, you got to defend the dollar. The dollar is just getting killed in international currency markets. Here it's a little more subtle, but sort of similar, which is they began losing the long end of the curve, losing control over it. You know, that 10-year rate is the policy rate, right? That drives a lot of what goes on in this economy. And I think that ultimately, if they know global central banks aren't buying, they got to get capital back here and they got to shake things up. And if that means risk has to suffer, that means risk has to suffer, but they got to have control along into that curve. And so I think that's ultimately what I think we're talking about here, which is, you know, same sort of direction, not exactly the same, but rhyming.
Now, I want to take this from the other side before we move off of this topic. This is a question I asked Jeffrey Sherman when he was on the program lately, which is a couple of years ago, DoubleLine made a projection that they could see a 6% 10-year yield. And, you know, I certainly can easily relate to why they could see fundamentals driving markets in that direction. But I just say, wait a minute. How does the United States government possibly service its debt at a 6% 10-year yield with the amount of debt that we have. You know, we're already right now pretty much at the highest level of debt service cost in history, but we're also at lowest rates in history. If we were to go back to a 6% treasury yield on the 10-year, we would double the U.S. government's cost of servicing its debt, and it would become essentially double the highest GDP percentage that it's ever been ever in history. And I can't believe that's possible. And Jeffrey Sherman was very quick to say, oh yeah, if it happens, all hell's going to break loose and you'd have to have some inflation. And I kind of thought, some inflation? Wouldn't that necessitate just massive inflation? So I guess my question to you is, first of all, how far can the long end of the curve go from here before it creates some kind of U.S. government funding crisis? And whenever that point is, when you get there, what starts to break? I mean, is it a case of we just get a fiscal crisis, or does the government change course and stop pursuing a policy that's going to make its own cost of borrowing unserviceable? It seems like, you know, the impossible trilemma also has another dimension here, which is just how do you possibly service U.S. government debt?
Well, to me, I think that's one of the big governors on this, especially once you appreciate, you know, we didn't quite get to the slide, but look, you know, we're a consumer economy. We are a consumption economy. 2/3 of GDP is personal consumption expenditures, right? And 200% of annual PCE growth, you know, let me back up. Net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions annually, the total of that number are equal to 200% of annual growth of personal consumption expenditures. Now, PCE is a big, broad category. It's not just stuff you're buying at Walmart. And I'm not saying that people are using net capital gains and taxable IRA distributions to fund all of that per se. What I am saying is, as you can see in the tax receipt data, stocks are important to the economy. This is the correlation that you hear a lot of people say, well, equities are expensive. The Warren Buffett metric says you mark equity market cap is 150% of GDP. And we have a chart of that on slide 15. The corollary to equity market cap is 150% of GDP is equity market cap is 150% of GDP. No one wants to talk about it, but the equity market is increasingly the U.S. economy. And so when you take a step back and start thinking about, hey, what are the implications of the 10-year going to 6? Can it even get there? Now you're going to be looking at a situation where why would I ever have any money in stocks if I could get 6 on a 10-year? So you got to take equities down. Well, that's going to take your tax receipts down, which is going to mean that whatever number you thought you needed for whatever you thought your deficit number was, your deficit number is going to be rising two ways. Number one, it's going to be rising because your interest expense is rising. And number two, it's going to be rising because your tax receipts are falling because you're so exposed to both rising home prices and other assets that are heavily interest rate sensitive. And they're also going to be getting hit because the equity side of things is going to be getting hit as well. So you're basically going to be coming in to like weekly estimates like, hey, coming in the Monday morning strategist from XYZ Capital. And yeah, the U.S. fiscal deficit estimate, we're taking it up another 10% this week, up another 12%. Like you're going to be chasing this moving bogey. And that's why ultimately when you say, hey, has my long-term structural view on the dollar changed? And the answer is no. Because ultimately, I continue to think the way this movie ends is, to answer your question, I don't know what the magic rate is where things start to get hairy. It's not 6, in my opinion. I feel very strongly about that. Is it 3.5? Is it 4? Is it 4.5? I don't know. I'd be, you know, 4.5 would probably be at the upper end of where I had to guess there. But the bottom line is, you know, history has shown the only other time in history that the U.S. had this high level of debt and global central banks weren't funding that debt in terms of growing their stockpiles of treasuries was during World War II. And the Fed came in and said, hey, we'll buy every 10-year you issue at 2.5%. And so they basically, you know, they did. The Fed ran the BOJ cap yields playbook the last time the U.S. was in the situation it is in today. And so, you know, can they get the 6? Theoretically, yes. Practically, no. I think the Fed caps yields like the BOJ did well before then to make sure that the government gets what they need. And to me, that's highly dollar negative ultimately and highly equity market positive.
Okay, thanks so much. I wanted to clarify those points before continuing on. I think I interrupted you somewhere around slide 15 or 16 as you were talking about the resolution of the trilemma, and I would assume that this leads us into where the trades are with respect to the U.S. dollar and what time horizons are associated with them. So please continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we were on, I think, slide 14, and it was a great quote from Alan Greenspan 3 years ago. Surprisingly large percent of U.S. income tax receipts are tied to a rise in U.S. stock prices. When the U.S. stock market just stops rising, not falls, but just stops rising, that will put pressure on the receipt side of the U.S. fiscal picture, which no one is talking about. And they weren't talking about it then. They're still not talking about it now. You know, that led us to just look at some of the IRS data, and you can see that chart there. Look, it's net capital gain plus IRA distributions as a percent of year-over-year growth in PCE. Those two numbers are, you know, the one number is 200% of the other number. And again, that's not to say one's funding the other, but it gives you a sense of the scale of importance of the stock market. And you go to slide 15, you know, we just mentioned this Warren Buffett metric. Yeah, stocks are expensive, but they better not fall because, you know, my guess is if they just stop going up, let alone fall, give it a couple months, you'll see softer home sales, you'll see softer auto sales, you'll see softer PCE broadly speaking. And so it's interesting, you go to slide 16. In the first quarter 18, the dollar stopped falling for the first time in 18 months, you know, within the framework of this trilemma. Stocks fell quarter on quarter for the first time in 2 years, as you can see here in this chart. And you go to slide 17, voila, personal consumption expenditures posted its weakest growth in over 5 years, which is a little blue lines, the original initial and revised numbers. And so, you know, you go to slide 18, within those PCE numbers, some of the bottoms up looks, the parts of the consumer that are weakest are the parts of the U.S. consumer that look most like an emerging market, the subprime side. So prime auto loan delinquencies look fine. Subprime, they're worse than they were in the crisis. Credit card charge-off rates at small banks, not so good. You're back to where you are in the crisis. Big banks, they're ticking up, but they're not to where the small banks are. And so, you know, the bottom line is you go to slide 19, the bottom line on dollar trade number one is, look, we think it'll work until higher rates, strong dollar weigh on U.S. economic trends. And we think U.S. equity markets are the likely transmission mechanism, as we talked about. And so if we're right, we think it's going to become more obvious by late third quarter and possibly force the Fed to revisit rate hike plans. And to date, what we've seen makes us very comfortable with our outlook. We've had this outlook for the past almost 4 months. You know, we're still there. Remember, Alan Greenspan's point, if stocks just stop going up, other than like five stocks, stocks haven't risen in nearly 6 months now. So that's kind of where we are there. And that brings us to, you know, dollar trade number two, and we'll get to this pretty quickly because some of it's familiar to your listeners and some of it, you know, ties into our view. But we highlighted this the last time we had this gap between the budget balance and the unemployment rate. Eventually, it forced the U.S. to unilaterally end the Bretton Woods system, go off the gold standard. It brought us the 1970s inflation, dollar weakness that ultimately had to be resolved with Volcker doing what he did. You go to slide 21. What we really think is going on in terms of Fed's need to defend the dollar this time is China and other people's accelerating efforts to de-dollarize global commodity markets, which take on a new tone in the context of foreign central banks not buying treasuries any longer. There's a number of different headlines here highlighting the relatively successful versus very limited expectations launch of the Chinese oil contract. You go to slide 22. Still seems like it's mostly retail in Shanghai, but, you know, as you can tell from sort of the gap between open interest and average volume, but average volume has been okay. It's interesting as you go to slide 23, to our eyes, it appears the U.S. has responded to, you know, this growing threat of the de-dollarization of global commodity markets by effectively trying to weaponize both the dollar and oil against Russia and Iran specifically. You know, it's interesting. You look at U.S. crude oil exports here on slide 23. We highlight where Donald Trump said we're going to try to be energy dominant. And, you know, we've seen U.S. exports basically spike up almost immediately to all-time highs. You can also see what's happened to the price of crude oil on slide 24 since Donald Trump announced that. He announced that oil was, call it, 46. You know, it went to 72 on WTI in a little over, you know, 9 months, which is a heck of a move. And then, by the way, in pretty linear fashion. Now, that gets us to slide 25, which I think is a really sum of what we're talking about. Everyone wants to look at this purely on the numbers, purely on the quantitative side. And the challenge is with what we're talking about here, some of it is qualitative. You got to kind of look at some of what's happening. And, you know, to us, you know, U.S. attempts to weaponize the dollar and even burn down the world or, you know, the airstrike inside the wire, We ask a question we had in a report a couple weeks ago is, you know, has that hit a UK Suez moment for the United States? And by that, we mean, you know, there was a moment in 1955 or 56 when, you know, the UK invaded the Suez. And Ike just basically said, yeah, we're not supporting you in France. We can't throw the Arab world under the bus. And what you can see here in these headlines is that even our staunchest allies are not happy with our attempt to dictate energy policy to all of them. You know, there's a great quote here from Bloomberg where a UK banker said, "You effing Americans, who are you going to tell us the rest of the world that that we can't deal with the Iranians?" Now, interestingly, that was 6 years ago. So can you imagine the level of frustration now? And so in the context of that, you go to slide 26. All of a sudden, things that were not allowed to be written and said about U.S. reserve status in quote unquote serious financial media are being said over and over and over. Here's 5 stories from the FT, from The Economist, from Bloomberg, from Reuters, all talking about explicitly this Iran sanctions are a threat to the U.S. dollar's reserve status, which is interesting because, you know, as you go to slide 27, as we've highlighted, I think in the dollar discussion we had with Mark and yourself and Jeff back in December, Barack Obama said the exact same thing 3 years ago, as you can see on slide 27. You know, you had Charles Gav on your show a little over a month ago. He highlighted how the Chinese are looking to effectively use gold to internationalize the yuan and de-dollarize at the same time. He had a great quote. We took an excerpt of that on slide 28. You go to slide 29. Charles said that if gold goes up, China's winning. If gold goes down, the U.S. is winning. And as you look here, this is the gold to oil ratio. Gold has been going up. Gold's been going up since 2009 fairly steadily, but in very volatile fashion in terms of real money or in terms of oil. It recently hit just below that critical 20 level and bounced in the last couple of weeks. You go to slide 30, same thing. If gold goes up, China's winning. Gold goes down, U.S. is winning. Something happened in 2017 between gold and real rates. They separated and they've not come back. You know, even with today notwithstanding, you know, this is updated as of last week. There's been a big gap there. Something's happening. And so when you talk about how does this filter into the trades, in the back half of the year, you go to slide 31, we're looking at this tale of $2 trades framework within this impossible trilemma. You know, near term, you know, we look for the Fed to continue tightening to try to support the dollar. We don't think it's a good outlook for risk assets broadly. We think it's particularly bad for emerging markets, bad for commodities. You know, the governors on this are sort of the shoot the hostage, burn down the world. And you know, when do U.S. equity markets not rising weigh enough on U.S. GDP growth to actually begin to have a different discussion? And I think that different discussion is really, really critical for your listeners, which is that at some point here, if we're right, you know, you're going to see a continued slowing in the U.S. economy. And once we get that slowing, if equities don't rise ad infinitum on low volume, if we get that slowing, then the Fed's going to have to show their hands of that question of was asked last recently, which was how much of this is just a Fed rate hiking cycle? How much of this is the Fed being weaponized to defend the dollar? Because that's going to be a real interesting day. You start getting some softer U.S. economic data, which, you know, I think is common. And if the Fed says, nope, we're good for 2 more this year and 3 more next year at least, then the markets may have to start to factor in that burning down the world or Volcker playbook. And if they do that, that's not going to be a good day for pretty much anything except for very short-term dated U.S. paper. I think the curve inverts notably. It'll be great for the dollar. But ultimately, that then ties back to this more structural dollar trade, which is U.S. creditors are still de-dollarizing the global commodity trade at an accelerating rate. The alternative to a dollar-centric system is nearly ready to go. We didn't get into it to a great degree for brevity's sake, but there's a London gold pool too, if you will, going on and has been going on since 2013, which is to say China, Russia, et cetera, are buying ever more physical gold, regardless of what the price does. And there's only so much physical gold. And there's sort of a binary risk to that. And so, you know, we continue to be in the longer run very negative on the dollar. Ultimately, this setup means one of three things must happen later this year. Either global central banks have to begin buying treasuries again. Either the U.S. has to convince China and Russia to stop doing what they're doing up to and including going to war with them. Or the U.S. has to go to its baby boomers and its DOD and the Department of Defense and say, hey, sorry, you know, we need to cut your budgets a bunch. If they don't do that, then, you know, one of three things will likely happen. You'll either have risk assets with another risk off stretch in the back half. The Fed will have to back up on their 3 rate hikes this year, next year narrative, or the dollar will have to weaken. And, you know, I guess to wrap up, as we came into this, you know, year, we thought, okay, the order of these was okay, the dollar weaker, and maybe the Fed will have to back off, and then risk assets, you know, would have been our third. And as a result of what we saw in February with the long end of the curve selling off with stocks, that forced us to reorder this. You know, we now think it's number one is risk assets likely to have another risk off stretch. We think number two is Fed will have to back off 3 rate hikes this year, next year. And you know, we think at least in the near term, you know, they're going to continue to try to defend the dollar. So maybe I'll stop there and open it up for questions.
I want to come back to a point that you touched on page 21, which is we discussed at greater length in your last interview on Macro Voices. At the time, the Shanghai yuan-denominated oil contract had not yet started trading. There was a lot of speculation on both sides of the fence. There were some people saying this is the most important thing ever. There were a lot of people dismissing it, saying it's maybe at best a symbolic gesture, but it's meaningless in terms of trade and actually getting any realistic amount of traction or market share. It has actually seen more volume in terms of contracts traded than a lot of people expected. But I'd like to go a level deeper, which is, what is your perspective, having now seen the way this has played out so far? Does this cause you to say, okay, so it's interesting, but it didn't go quite as much as I thought, and maybe the pace is going to be slower for de-dollarization? Or does it make you feel like, hey, baby, it's game on, and this proves it? Or is it something in between?
I think it's something in between. So the week before that contract launched, we had a report for our subscribers, and the title of it was, you know, for want of a nail, you know, the yuan oil contract finally set to launch. Near-term effects are likely muted, but second-order geopolitical and foreign exchange impacts could be enormous. And the for want of a nail is in reference to the famous poem, right? For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the knight was lost. For want of a knight, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. So a kingdom was lost, all for want of a nail. And that was really, we thought, emblematic or symbolic of how we saw this contract. We didn't think we were going to do, you know, anything that was going to change the world instantly. Anyone that did, that was not our view. It was never our view. But to me, the most interesting thing, and we've written about this a number of different times, has been not so much where we've seen it in the markets yet. And the volume was better than expected. I think, you know, quite a bit better than expected, and has been more persistent than expected. And some of the players who traded it surprised some people in terms of some international oil companies, some of the Swiss trading houses, et cetera. But by and large, I don't think it's been that big a deal. Where I think the biggest impact can be seen has been in the geopolitical arena since this was almost, you know, in the lead up to this being launched and since, which is, look, there is, you know, everything we're accusing China of doing, the IP theft, trade unfairness, all this stuff. Like, you couldn't find someone in America who's a mid-level exec or higher that didn't know all of this stuff for the past 15 years. We've known this for a long, long time. We wrote a report back in March highlighting just all of the news stories from the prestige Western financial and broader mainstream media, where all of a sudden President Xi's on the cover of Economist in a photo shot that's usually reserved for guys like Vladimir Putin or for Saddam Hussein or for Chavez down in Venezuela. The narrative on China changed so fast and so violently. That, to us, was a much bigger clue than anything we've seen in the markets yet. And to us, the importance of the yuan oil contract, China had to openly show their hand. This is what we're trying to do. We are trying to use the dollar system against itself. We are not buying treasuries anymore. We are taking the dollars we're earning in trade, and we are going straight to the source. We're going to Africa. We're going to Asia. We're going to Europe. We're going everywhere, and we're locking up supplies, and we're going to change the pricing of them in time to our own currency. And that way, you know, we will have the ability to manage our own current account. And so we kind of ran through that in this report and others since. And so to me, the biggest tell has been, I mean, look, U.S. trade relations since March, 3 months, they've gotten worse in 3 months than they were in the 25 years before. I think that that's a huge clue. And it's something, again, because it's qualitative and not quantitative, you know, Wall Street, show me the number. You know, $200 billion on Monday. How's that for a number?
Luke, that is a number indeed. I'll tell you another number that's on my mind, which is the very rapid pace at which our August 10th Macro Voices Live event is selling out in Toronto. I talked to you a little bit off the air because we'd like to give our listeners a teaser. You're one of our featured speakers at that event. I want to give our audience at least an indication of what you'll be talking about. You told me you'd kind of like to leave room to things are moving and changing so quickly. I think that your topic is the latest, greatest stuff, which you're not sure what that is yet. But how about at least a little bit of a teaser as to what maybe our listeners can expect? I would imagine we didn't really have time to finish this conversation as much as I would like to about China and de-dollarization and Sergei Glazyev and a whole bunch of topics. Is that part of it? What else are the possibilities is what we might hear from you at Macro Voices Live on August 10th in Toronto?
I'm really excited to present. And I think where we're leaning at this point, based on what we're sort of seeing and talking about, is you know, talking more about what's going on with the trade situation between China and the U.S. And by that, I mean, I think there's a lot of really great analysis being done on the relative trade balances between the U.S. and China and sort of physical volumes that are moving and sort of, all right, in a tit for tat, you know, trade war, you know, U.S. wins or China wins. And there's a lots of different opinions. And like I said, some really great analysis. But to me, in my opinion, what is happening on the trade side between the U.S. and China is not the main event. To me, it's just a symptom of the main event. And so what we really want to talk about in Toronto is more of the main event, which is right now, you know, volatility is still relatively low in markets, broadly speaking, you know, emerging markets notwithstanding in the last couple of weeks. But we think a lot of people are mistaking low volatility for what we think is actually really two epic tectonic plates pressing very, very hard against each other to a standstill. And we think there's a number of things that could cause one or the other or both of these plates to slip in the back half of this year, so to speak. And at that point, it will become apparent that, you know, what was a low volatility situation was not so low vol. It was just a temporary standstill between two big forces pressing against each other. So, you know, I think we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how this trade war is just a symptom of a broader issue. And that given the broader issue in question, why anytime someone says, well, it's not going to get much worse, we're skeptical because there's two very structural red line, you know, tectonic forces pressing against each other. And it makes for a very interesting and potentially important slash explosive situation in the back half of the year for a number of different risk assets. And so we'll be talking, I think, a lot about that. And it'll be real fun to go through that with the attendees and the audience.
Well, we're really working to design this to be as intimate of an event as we can. It's set up with a number of different speakers, and then there's a discussion panel where we can take audience questions, and then there's a meet and greet to give all of us a chance to meet the listeners and spend some time actually having a beer with them. So I'm looking forward to it very much. I know you are. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Luke. I'm so looking forward to him being a part of the show out in August. You know, I'm looking forward to picking his brain on some of his ideas because I don't fully agree with everything. Well, at least on the surface, maybe it's because I don't fully understand all the concepts. But one thing I do agree with is his tactical view on the short term of the U.S. dollar rising. I really do think that there's something going on here that is not about that long-term, big-picture, fundamental U.S. dollar weakening, but there's really a squeeze going on. Maybe it's the rate differentials, maybe it's any other of these variables, but I'm certainly thinking that he's right on the short term, that there's more upside on the dollar in the going into the second half of the year. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, my take was very similar. I am particularly impressed with Luke's flexibility because, frankly, something I've noticed is that, first of all, not a lot of people in finance are able to get their head around the reasons why the dollar's fall from prominence and loss of hegemony over the global financial system really is inevitable. It's going to happen sooner or later. And so many people just get stuck and they, oh, that's impossible. We've never seen something like that happen before in our lifetime. It couldn't be. Well, it's going to happen, folks. And what I've noticed is that usually the people who are able to see that longer picture are not very good tactically. What happens is they see that it's inevitable that the dollar has to lose that hegemony over the global financial system. They studied Triffin's paradox and so forth, and they know why it has to happen. And then they get themselves into this mindset that says, okay, it's inevitable, so therefore I'll assume it must be imminent. And it's not imminent. It's not. I think that there's probably lots of upside left in this dollar rally. And it really impresses me to see a guy like Luke, who is just so passionate in his dollar bearish view, be ready to say, hey, but guess what? That's long term, and short term, I think the exact opposite. And to me, it's not a conflict at all. It really shows the flexibility of Luke's ability as an analyst to think in different time frames. So I think he's got it right in terms of both the long term bearish view. I just think it might be even longer term than he thinks. And I think he's also right in the short term that the dollar trend is up right now. But in any case, Patrick, I want to shift gears now because you put together another fantastic chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download in your Research Roundup email. It says Postgame Chart Book. Patrick, go ahead, starting on page 2, talk us through what you're looking at here.
Well, what I did this week was I wanted to put a couple charts together all over the map. Just some interesting things that I observed that are happening in the markets that I wanted to bring to our listeners' attention. So on page 2, I just wanted to talk about gold. And what was really interesting is when I overlaid a chart of the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar, and gold futures, what is really interesting is to observe how strongly they're correlated together. I've always loved that opinion that shared by Alan Greenspan that said gold is 50% a commodity and 50% a currency. And what I find interesting about that is that really right now gold is just behaving like a cross currency to the US dollar. And so as the US dollar has been rising, we've been seeing a lot of these commodity driven currencies weakening, and so has gold. And you know, we've had a number of guests talk about the eventual decoupling of this, but right now there is zero evidence that gold is doing anything other than being a cross currency to the dollar.
You know, it's interesting to me, though, to observe, look at what the others are doing and notice that gold is not as far. And this goes back to my comment in the market wrap. It seems like gold is being a little bit more resilient because I usually think precious metals are kind of emotional markets. They tend to overreact. I would almost expect gold to move farther than the currencies, but it's not gone as far to the downside, at least in this recent move.
Absolutely. You know, and that's, and anyway, we'll see how it plays out. I don't want to make a forecast by that, but certainly the one thing we will observe here is simply that gold is just behaving like a cross to that US dollar, and we shouldn't expect that to change. And when we do, I'm sure we'll point it out to our listeners if we see a decoupling of this trend. So moving on, though, I wanted to talk about the chart on page 3, which you mentioned at the pregame. And what I wanted to show in this first chart on 3 is showing the past. It was showing a chart of the 2017 synchronized global growth narrative, which was emerging markets were roaring higher. We were seeing markets like the Shanghai Index doing well. And you saw, at least in the first 9 months of the year, currencies like the Mexican peso doing incredibly well. And everything from emerging market bonds, whether we're talking in local currency or whether denominated in US dollars, everything was going together up. It was the U.S. dollar down and everything else ups narrative that happened in 2017. And that's what made 2017 such a bullish year. It's like it didn't matter what you bought. Long as you weren't heavy in U.S. dollars, you made money. But what's interesting is that once January rolled around on page 4, that story ended quickly. Obviously, the U.S. dollar put in that bottom. It was more in the at the start of the second quarter of the year. But what we can really see is that it was actually back in January where the bigger trend reversed. And now we have all of these charts in 2018 showing from the top left to the bottom right. And what's interesting to me about this chart is that this is a real pain point in the emerging markets, because, you know, we've had a number of guests come onto our show and they're talking about that really big risk moment where we would see the US dollar declining the same time as bonds are declining, as rates are shooting up and stock markets go down. And it's this perfect Armageddon moment where all assets are declining and everything blows up. And it's interesting, we're not seeing that in the US, but we are seeing that very scenario develop in the emerging markets, where we're seeing all of these emerging market currencies declining, all of the emerging market bonds declining, and all emerging market equities declining all simultaneously. And while I don't want to suggest that that means that there has to be some massive crisis that this ends with, but it's certainly the stress points that lead to a potential event. And it'll be interesting to see whether this trend continues. The one thing I'll emphasize, though, is that we are quite oversold on many of these. I mean, as we speak, there's nothing out of line for us to have this entire sequence take a pause into the summer, but it has been the prevailing trend all year.
Okay, Patrick, so that's an important point. Just because this trend is in play, this is not necessarily a good entry point for shorts here, because as you say, it's already oversold, maybe overdue for a bounce. So be careful there, folks. Let's move on to U.S. equity markets. What do you have going on here in slide five?
What I thought it was just really interesting to continue to point out to our listeners is that the U.S. equity markets have really been a tale of two style of investments. Because if you've been long the small caps or technology spaces, in this case of the QQQ and the Russell 2000, I mean, you're up anywhere from 10 to 15% on the year. While what's really interesting is anyone who invested in those really solid blue chip Dow Jones style stocks is actually flat on the year. And it's pretty amazing to see that there's two very different style of investments that are, and two different style of investment results that are, people are getting depending on how they built their portfolios. So if somebody's been incredibly heavy, high dividend, big blue chip names, their performance has been struggling all year, while somebody who's been long the cyclicals and technologies and driving that trend very hard, you're getting a real momentum and performance. And what an interesting thing will be is, when will this start to converge? When does this divergence apart really start to come back in? It'll be very interesting to see where the bottoms come in on those big blue chips.
Let's focus on the S&P 500 specifically. It looks like you're moving to a four-hour chart on page six. Tell us what that's about.
Well, when our listeners are looking at this chart, this is a chart that we've been showing continuously over the last 3 months, every couple of episodes. So what we've continued to see is the summer rally really kind of ensued in May, and we've had a market that progressed back toward the March highs. We identified the overhead resistance levels at 2,800, and back when we showed this chart on June 7th, we suggested that this should be a place where short-term overhead resistance actually holds, and we should see throwbacks in the S&P 500, just a little washout to kind of get all of the weak hands shaken out of the market. But I still continue to be of the opinion that this is still a rally that is going to last into the summer, and that this will provide a buy-on dip. But what I wanted to really show on this chart was some of the interesting levels that our listeners can watch on the S&P 500 where a potential reversal could occur. Now, of course, a consolidation just even up here around 2750 could be a turn point. But really, if there's one more leg of selling going into the weekend or early next week, I'm going to be watching that 2720 to 2735 level and the S&P about 2030 S&P points lower, where there could be an initial support line that will be bought on dip. A very, very deep sell-off could go all the way to 2,700. Not my favorite scenario, but it could happen. The one thing that if we continue to see this S&P 500 develop in a manner that suggests that there's a big extended topping formation developing, and that 2018 will just be the top of the bull market, then we should see deep throwbacks, because what ends up happening during those periods is that the market's transitioning from this beautiful bull trend that's been in place almost a better part of a decade, and now we're seeing active distribution into strength, and that makes the topping process very choppy. My first intuition is we don't make that kind of a drop, but it can happen. Where I would completely go back to the drawing board and ask, is something bigger or more ominous happening, would be if we saw the S&P break below 2700 and stay down there, and we're just not seeing the buy on dip traders show up. Suddenly my alarm bells would be running there, and I would start going back and trying to say, well, what is happening here? But at least for now, I'm approaching this as going to be a buy on dip opportunity. I'm going to be still looking for a push into July that could even see the highs back near 2900 retested.
So we've got a wide range of possibility for what could happen with the market. Meanwhile, moving on to the final slide, we've got a reminder here, folks. Our ticket sales have been brisk, and this is a small venue that we rented for our first live event. So if you're able to join us on August 10th in Toronto, be sure to follow that link in your Research Roundup email and get your tickets now while you still can. You have pictures of the various different guests that we'll have speaking here. You heard from Luke a little bit about what he's going to be talking about, and we'll have a little bit more information for you in coming weeks about what the other speakers will be presenting on. But in any case, be sure to move fast and get your tickets now while the getting is good. Meanwhile, folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. Hey, if OPEC ministers are listening, you should be too, and so should your friends and colleagues. So please forward your Research Roundup emails, send them to everybody you know, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, and most importantly, go to macrovoices.com and register your free account. It'll only take a minute. We won't spam you or try to sell you anything. And the benefit to you is you'll receive our free Research Roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just links to download all of the best free stuff you can find on the internet, both the supporting materials from our own programming here at Macro Voices, as well as all of the best other content that we can find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
So in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to Luke Roman's chart book. Also, the chart book that you and I discussed in the post game is also available. There's also an interesting article talking about David Rosenberg's perspective that the Fed is responsible for 1,000 S&P 500 points of the upside, and a Nick Cunningham article that Canada's oil crisis is far from over. Also, you'll find a link to an interesting video interview between Lloyd Blank Find and Paul Tudor Jones. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.